Ian Fleming created one of the great 20th century icons in James Bond, a character whose global cultural impact still informs our age. Fleming himself was often conflated with Bond in the public's mind, not always favorably. An oft-caricatured man's man and complicated lover of women with an adventurous, if shrouded, past. A colleague called him, quote, the most generous, least malicious, most merry, yet most melancholy man I ever knew. In the new book, Ian Fleming, The Complete Man, literary biographer and novelist Nicholas Shakespeare takes a deep dive into the life of Ian Fleming, who alone could have created James Bond, providing a fresh portrait of contradictions that draws a never-before-accessed private archives. It is a great pleasure to welcome Nicholas Shakespeare to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, Nicholas. A great pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me.
Congratulations on the book. It is out today, and I greatly enjoyed this story. I just think in reading what I just read, that idea, just that one quote of least malicious, most generous, most merry, yet most melancholy man I ever knew, that would be a dream for a biographer.
Yes. I mean, I have to say I'm a novelist before I'm a biographer. And so when I was asked 5 years ago by the Fleming estate if I would write the first authorized biography since 1966, my first reaction was a bit of hesitation because I didn't know too much about Fleming. I knew about Bond. And Bond, in a sense, has kind of drowned out and suffocated Fleming in a way that another writer I admired, John le Carré, we think of le Carré before we think of his character George Smiley, but it's the opposite with Fleming and Bond. And I think my initial reaction was hesitation because glimpsing him out of the corner of my eye, he seemed to be a typical English bounder, a kind of old Etonian sardonic woman chaser, woman beater, who didn't seem a very sympathetic character. And I suppose one of the morals of his story, which I only realized a few weeks ago, is don't run off with the wife of the owner of the Daily Mail if you wish to avoid forever after being rendered into tabloid fat, because in a sense his image for the last 50 or 60 years has been a tabloid bounder. And so I asked the Fleming and said, well, look, do I want to spend 3 or 4 years in the company of a cat? Not really. But give me a couple of months of due diligence to see if, you know, he's more interesting than that. And the quote you've just quite rightly singled out by his great friend Robert Harling summarized that he was a much more interesting figure. The image I had of him was a very unimportant desk officer in the war who'd been in charge of in-trays, out-trays, and ash-trays, and he kind of pretended to be important, and that this was very far from the case. The two things I discovered in my due diligence is that he was a much kinder man. So all the women he'd been in love with or who'd been in love with him, enough to fill the Albert Hall, said Rebecca West, they all spoke of him with the same word, kindness, again and again. And that's kindness is a great quality for a biographer to kind of retrieve, especially when you don't think of the creator of James Bond or James Bond. That word doesn't really naturally fit with him. The second thing I discovered, he's far more important. He wasn't a desk officer, a chocolate sailor. He was in the inner sanctum of British intelligence in a way that John le Carré and Graham Greene, two other English writers I knew, I didn't know Fleming, but I knew le Carré and Greene, they were just minor functionaries in British intelligence. Fleming was the absolutely epicenter in the inner citadel, and he had so many fingers in so many pies, not only in Europe creating a commander unit which went ahead of the troops to gather Enigma machines and code books which they could send back to Bletchley Park and which helped to shorten the war, some people think, by 18 months, but also with his special relationship with America, which was essentially an intelligence relationship. And in April 1941, Fleming goes over, one of only two or three people, to Washington and New York to try and help America set up the first foreign intelligence service, which they didn't have at that moment. And Fleming is in the room with William Donovan, who becomes the first chief, and what is the COI and then becomes the OSS, and then in 1947 becomes the CIA, is based on Fleming's kind of blueprint, which he draws from naval intelligence in Britain. So in summary, he became a much kinder and more important person, and that really was a prize for a biographer to go and root him out.
One of the things that really surprised me of the book, and I just was not aware of this, is that he did not publish Casino Royale, that the novel that introduced Bond to the world, until 1953. He was 43 years old and had lived a hell of a life before that.
Well, in a sense, he starts Bond when his interesting life is over. He's about to get married, and he can't face that. And so he sits down at the typewriter to try and retrieve his bachelor self, which explores all the operations that he'd been responsible for in the Second World War, but he redresses them against instead of the Nazi enemy, he redresses it in fiction against the Russian communist enemy. And I think it's forgotten that be somebody we'd want to know about. But he was, as I say, in the room when all the important decisions were being made, both in Britain and in America.
Well, okay, so we lost some of that. You dropped out for a minute, so if I'm repeating something you just said, I apologize. But one of the things that I'm interested in is, and again, I mentioned this in the introduction, but you had access to these private archives, and that's pretty much everything that he wrote. What was that like, and how does that give us a clearer picture of who this guy was?
Well, I think in the first instance, it shows you that he was a very, very important figure in the Second World War. His boss in naval intelligence, Admiral Godfrey, called Fleming a war winner. And I think that access to the papers helped put some of that together. I mean, many of the papers, the intelligence papers, have been burnt or destroyed or misplaced. So you have to be quite speculative, but it's clear that the story you can piece together with some of the material I was given by the family helped me to kind of rehabilitate him as a much more important figure and a much more interesting figure and a much more sympathetic figure. And I wasn't expecting that.
When he is it fair to say, as you say, he had lived this incredible life and then starts to write. How did fame change him? Or did it?
I think, sadly, it's a kind of Frankenstein story in that he always wanted to be better than his brother, who was a very well-known travel writer, Peter Fleming, and a kind of a model example of a hero. And part of Bond is also based on his brother, Peter. And Peter completely overshadowed him all his life, and I think he really wanted to match up to him. And suddenly, towards the end of his life, he's selling, you know, in his last year, I think he's sold 40 million books, which is a kind of unthinkable for an English writer in those days. And the films are coming out. Dr. No comes out, and From Russia with Love comes out. And the President of the United States, Jack Kennedy, has read all his books and singles out From Russia with Love as one of his favorite novels. So suddenly he's like completely inundated with fame in a way that the English aren't really used to. And I spoke to a man who sat next to him at one of his clubs, Boodle's Club. He's a 22-year-old officer called Algie Clough, and he sat next to Fleming in about 1963 and said, you must be enjoying all this publicity. And Fleming said, no, I hate it. It's not what I want. And Clough said, well, what is it you want? And Fleming said, I'd like to be the captain of the Royal St. George's Golf Club, which he'd been a member of since 1948. And one of the sadnesses of his life, or perhaps it's a happiness, in that 2 days before he dies, he is elected captain designate of this golf club. And he has one day on the golf course enjoying the smell of the wild garlic and playing. And then he gets ill the following day and dies the day later. So he achieves, that was his ambition, I think, in the end, not to be famous or rich. He wanted to be among his friends on the golf course.
We have about 5 or 6 minutes, and there's a lot of different things I want to talk to you about. Let me go through my list. One is, so we are in upstate New York. Albany is part of our listening area. I know he resided at a time in an estate in Washington County and on the Vermont border, and would often go to Saratoga. There's quite a bit of question and of interest in our region of what exactly he wrote and how much time he spent in that part of the world.
Well, his best friend from school, who he met on a beach in England aged 8, was a man called Ivor Bryce, who was at Eton with him, and they became complete brothers. And Ivor marries, as his third wife, Jo Huntington Hartford, one of the richest women in America, who owned the grocery chain that had made her fortune. And
AMP,
they
right.
had this... That's right. And she had this farm, Black Hill Hollow Farm, near
yes.
Saratoga. And from about 1954, probably the next 5 or 6 years, Fleming would go there every summer without his wife. His wife couldn't stand his kind of rich friends. And he and Ernie Cuneo, who lived also just down the road, who'd been a lawyer at the White House in the war and had known Fleming and Bryce during the war, they'd all been intelligence together. They try and resurrect a newspaper empire called the North American Alliance. And can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
And so he goes to every August to Vermont, and they kind of talk about these newspaper chain of newspapers that they're going to do stuff for, but it's just an excuse for a get-together. And Fleming, I think, he meets Woodward, who later is murdered by his wife, but comes a Truman Capote novel. And Woodward takes him to Saratoga and shows in his very fast car, a Studilac, I think, and Fleming buys one for himself, a slightly modified version. And I think it's Fleming's introduction to the super rich, which he brings into Diamonds Are Forever, Jo Huntington Hartford's, Jo Bryce's famous Afghan diamond, one of the biggest in the world, is on the cover of Diamonds Are Forever. And he writes some short stories that are based in that area. And I think some of the Saratoga mud baths, the scenes in his novels, are taken from that. So I think it became a very important American bolt hole that reminded him of his childhood in Scotland, where the Flemings came from, right up a place called Black Mount, up in north of Dundee. And so I think it was a home from home.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Fleming, right after he published Thunderball, and we're again going to go back to Cars here for a second, but Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is by Ian Fleming. Many people may not know that, but it is. Although it is in question of whether he actually wrote it or not.
Oh, no, I think he wrote it when he'd had a heart attack and he was in hospital and he was not allowed access to a typewriter. And so he picks up a pencil, and it's the only manuscript he wrote in pencil. And he writes it for his son, Casper. And it's based on a story he would tell Casper in Jamaica, which was the bungalow he bought just after the war and where he wrote all the Bond books. And he would go every winter for 2 months and write a Bond book. And Casper, he would tell on the plane or the journey out these stories of this car that flew or that could go underwater. And, yes, I think what's interesting is that the British Olympics in 2012, Ian Fleming is the only writer to have two characters present at the amazing opening ceremony. He first of all has Bond as the Queen's bodyguard, kind of floating down from the skies.
Right.
And then in the procession that goes round the stadium, he has the Dreamcatcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And So, he's become, as you earlier said, a cultural phenomenon, his characters. You can't go around the world without... everyone in the world knows of James Bond, I mean, in a way that they don't know of other characters. And every day in the press, there's a reference to James Bond. And, various United States presidents refer to him almost as if he's a real person. And I don't think there's another character, fictional or otherwise, that comes up to compare with James Bond. He seems to be a representative of both Britain, about what Britain feels of itself, what it likes to feel of itself. It's all nonsense, of course, but I think the rest of the world quite like it. And he's a kind of one-man band. I think this is why President Kennedy loved him. He was a one-man person who could save a country. And that accounted, I think, for Kennedy's absolute adoration of Ian Fleming and of the character.
In fact, after Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, he died shortly after that book was published. My last question for you is about when you look at the Bond books now specifically, of how they hold up?
Well, I think they hold up only because the films have continued the movement of Bond. I think if there hadn't been any films, we wouldn't be here talking delightfully to you, Joe, about Ian Fleming. I think he was a perfectly good number two ranker like John Buchan or Somerset Maugham. But it's the films that had to rely on the character, and you know what is it about that character that has allowed the films to, you know, 25 films or more have been made, and they can be in the future. They're so adaptable, and yet they have to rely on the character that Fleming wrote in the books. I think I did a whole, you know, before I started writing the book, the biography, I reread them all quickly, straight through, and they do stand up. I mean, he writes very well. He's a trained journalist at Reuters. He knows how to tell a story quickly. The pace is what's important. So he says, don't look at what you've done that day. Just power through 2,000 words a day. Don't look back because you'll be terrified. And I think that pace gives still an energy that we can respond to. Of course, you can kind of tinker with some of the aspects, I think, as the estate has done. I mean, I don't approve of editing him in a way, like Roald Dahl's been edited. But I think they still stand up. I think a young person reading those books would still enjoy them.
27 films, 28 films, right? Grossing more than $7 billion. He only lived to see two of them. A 70-cigarette... a day habit. Man.
Well, and three quarters of a bottle of gin, I think, as well.
That'll, that'll quicken the pace, won't it? Well, the book is endlessly fascinating. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it. Your writing is beautiful, and it's a telling of a fascinating individual. The name of the new book is, by Nicholas Shakespeare, it is Ian Fleming, The Complete Man. Thank you so much, Nicholas, for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for listening to me.
Be well. Thank you. A delight to listen to you. Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the new book, Ian Fleming, The Complete Man. It's published by Harper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.